from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On Monday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed a link between antibiotics given to livestock and the increase of antibiotic-resistant bacteria infections in people. At least 70% of all antibiotics in the United States are used to treat animals on farms and feedlots, and critics are urging for better regulations. We'll discuss the CDC report and what it means for consumers, farmers, and healthcare providers. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released a report on Monday confirming a connection between antibiotics administered to animals raised for human consumption and the increase of antibiotic infections in human beings, linking antibiotics to human death and estimating how many people die each year of infections that no longer respond to antibiotics. CDC Director Thomas Frieden called for urgent steps to scale back and monitor use or risk are returning to an era when common bacteria infections of the bloodstream, respiratory system, urinary tract, and skin routinely killed and maimed. This morning's opening forum hour, we want to focus on the CDC report and what it means, especially to consumers, healthcare providers, and farmers. And we should mention right up front here that we invited the CDC, but they were unavailable to join us. I want to welcome Jonathan Kaplan, who's here in studio, director of the Food and Agricultural Program with the National Resources Defense Council. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have with us by phone this morning from Washington, D.C., Richard Carnevale, who is Vice President of Regulatory Scientific and International Affairs for the Animal Health Institute. They're an animal pharmaceutical industry lobbying group, and I think I may have butchered your name there, Richard. My apologies. Carnevale. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we also have Jason Newland with us, who is Medical Director of Patient Safety with Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. He joins us from Kansas City this morning, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Let me begin with Jonathan Kaplan, who, as I said, is here with us in studio. And I suppose the big takeaway from this report from the CDC is danger to consumers, high priority health threat or risk. But also, the concern seems to be focused to a great extent on crowded feedlots.
Yeah, I think that's right. This report's important because for the first time, we're seeing CDC come out with actual numbers for number of deaths, number of illnesses attributed to antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and that's significant. And also because the agency is squarely linking animal agriculture as being a contributor to this problem. And that's not new news. Certainly, there's a huge body of literature making that point, and we'll get into that this morning, I'm sure. But the agency very clearly says in this report that livestock use of antibiotics, or much of it, is inappropriate and unnecessary and makes all of us less safe.
So also says that 70% of antibiotics in the United States are used to speed up growth in animals or to prevent diseases. And again, a lot of this is being done particularly in the feedlots. Livestock growers can buy antibiotics just over the counter at a feed store.
Yeah, it turns out a lot of the drugs used for animal agriculture don't require a prescription from a veterinarian. So that actually you or I could walk into a feedlot store and buy a 50-pound bag of the same antibiotics that you'd need a prescription to fill, you know, at a Walgreens here in San Francisco.
But lest we get some confusion here right away, there are 23,000 deaths the CDC attributed, but most of the problems with antibiotics still have to do with human consumption of antibiotics.
I think that's right. Certainly most of the fatalities that are talked about in this report happen in hospitals. And certainly human use is a very established driver for this problem. But both sources are important, and that's what that's what's significant here. Researchers cannot currently quantify how much of the problem is caused by animal agriculture and how much of the problem is caused by human use of antibiotics. But We know that both are important contributors, and we have to take on both of those sources.
We're talking again with Jonathan Kaplan, who is with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and there remains a sense of all this evidence. You alluded to it before that was found about, bacteria being essentially a problem in terms of what we now call superbugs and all these kinds of things. They were looking at this back in the 60s. Why has this been neglected so long? I mean, it remains sort of routine in industrial livestock facilities. And like you said, you can buy it over the counter, and nobody's ever questioned this, it seems. Or if they have, nothing's been done about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you wanted to breed a factory to produce superbugs, you would create the American feedlot of today. This is a system where you have lots of animals crowded into a confined space living in or near their own excrement. So there's a tremendous amount of disease pressure, and you're routinely administering low doses of antibiotics to these animals day after day. And what happens is that some of these bacteria inevitably become resistant to the antibiotics, and then those bacteria are able to breed, multiply, and escape from the feedlot through the air by colonizing workers, to water, to the manure that's then applied to other crops, and on the meat itself, which travels down the supply chain to grocery stores and to our homes. So what we've seen over the last several decades is the practice of antibiotic use has become widespread, is the rise of superbugs as a result.
Let me go to Richard Carnevale again, who's Vice President, Regulatory, Scientific, and International Affairs for the Animal Health Institute. They're an animal pharmaceutical industry lobbying group. And CDC report, Richard Carnevale, says that, much of the antibiotics that are used with animals are unnecessary, inappropriate, and makes all of us less safe.
Well, let me first comment on the discussion earlier. I guess I'm reading a different report than what the CDC came out with, because the CDC did not point the finger at animal antibiotic use to any great extent. Yes, they indicated there could be some contribution, primarily through the foodborne route, but only two of the 18 pathogens they identified in that report had any relationship to animal antibiotic use. So to try to say that the CDC and Dr. Frieden is blaming the biggest problem on antibiotics to animal antibiotic use is simply not true. The report clearly points out that antibiotic use in human medicine is the biggest concern, that those bacteria causing the biggest problem are primarily human pathogens, not animals. And in fact, the number of deaths attributed to Salmonella and Campylobacter, which could come from animal sources, is 0.002% of the total 23,000 deaths they notified in there. So I would take umbrage with the fact that this report points the finger to agriculture as the biggest source of the problem.
There's been a lot of talk about an 80% figure, which I know you also take umbrage with.
Yes, the 80% figure has been bandied about a lot. And, you know, really, it's not so much the total use of antibiotics, although I can tell you why the 80% is not right. For one thing, at least 40% of that total are probably drugs that aren't used in human medicine at all. And the fact is, the remaining antibiotics that are used in animals and humans are quite different as far as quantities go. For example, the 70% of the antibiotics that are reported by FDA are two compounds, the tetracyclines and the ionophores. The ionophores are not used in human medicine. Tetracyclines are, but if you look at the human data, they're only used about 15%. The 70% of the antibiotics used in human medicine are penicillins, fluoroquinolones, and cephalosporins. So the use of antibiotics between the two animals, between the animal sector and the human sector, are quite different. But getting back to the total, one would expect that there would be more antibiotic use on a quantity basis in animals. There are almost 40 times as many food-producing animals. Many of them are quite large. It's not really the total use that is the concern. It what is the impact on human health that has. And so far, we can't find a lot of evidence that antibiotic use has a significant impact on human health. And I think the CDC report kind of points that out.
And what about the concern, though, about production and cramming of livestock, crowded feedlots, factory farming used to essentially promote growth and prevent illness in animals, many feel it's unsafe and unsanitary and breeding superbugs.
Well, I don't like the term cramming and crowding because I don't think that's what happens. I think animals are raised in production facilities for efficiency purposes, yes, but their health is of utmost importance, and the fact is that you have to keep animals healthy, otherwise you lose them. So animals that producers aren't going to raise animals in conditions where they lose half of their herd, they're going to lose money. So obviously that's kind of a misnomer. Pigs are raised in covered production facilities to keep them safe and out of the environment. It keeps them away from pathogens, from predators, from other environmental problems. So I think I really don't like the term crowded and cramped conditions because I think it's clearly a misnomer.
Well, what do you say to, and I'm sure you'll hear some of this perhaps during when we open the lines up, but there's a lot of concern about particularly the antibiotic use with poultry and livestock, even though, as you point out, you may have only two of those antibiotics that are really relevant in a big way to human consumption. But the fact that the agriculture and pharmaceutical lobbies are making things difficult and making this problem all the more exacerbated.
I don't really know how to answer that question. I don't know. When you say we're making it more difficult, we follow all the rules that FDA lays down. These products are highly regulated by FDA. FDA has a process in place to look at residues in the food. They have a process in place to look at antimicrobial resistance. Antibiotics used in food animals are probably some of the most highly regulated products out there. And they continue to be highly regulated. FDA continues to look at the antibiotic resistance issue. They have just issued some guidelines in the last 2 years to try to remove and eliminate the use of some of these older antibiotics for growth promotion purposes. The industry supports that. They also want to put some of these medically important antibiotics under veterinary supervision. The industry supports that too. So I would say we're not making it worse. We're trying to comply with all the requirements that FDA lays down on us and are willing to work to try to make that better if there is a reason to make that better.
And again, Richard Carnevale with us from the nation's capital is with the Animal Health Institute, an animal pharmaceutical industry lobbying group. And Jason Newland is with us from Kansas City, Missouri. He's a medical director of patient safety with Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. Dr. Newland, I want to get you on record here. I know you're seeing a lot of cases that are concerned to you, seeing more superbugs, more infections in kids without those infections being able to be controlled through regular treatment. But how much can you at least assume or even deduce that this has to do with the way livestock and poultry are given antibiotics as opposed to the human side of the problem?
Well, I think that this is a very important issue, obviously, with what's come out. When it comes to the animal industry, the issue is that what the link that you're trying to look at to say specifically is so important, as was mentioned. And I would say that it is there. And the fact that we are trying to hide behind this excess use and saying, well, no, we're not seeing children that might be affected because we're using a lot of antibiotics in the animal industry, I think is crazy in some respects. We are seeing resistant campylobacter. We are seeing other resistant salmonella. Yes, it's a small portion. But the fact of the matter is they don't have to be resistant, and we don't have to do this. And also, there's other bacteria. There's acinetobacter. Acinetobacter are in the environment and in the soil. How can we say that these antibiotic use that isn't necessary in these animals doesn't have an impact there? I think there's more and more literature that's coming out that's showing that there is a link between what we're seeing in animals and it having some spread to the humans. Now, so for me, this is a multifaceted issue. It involves all of us. I mean, the human health industry is just as much an important part of this. We have to do a better job of taking care of our antibiotics, as does the animal industry. I think it needs to be pointed out that the FDA has been trying to put some regulations in place in the animal agriculture industry since 1977. I mean, that's 36 years ago. I mean, Elvis was alive 36 years ago. And nothing has happened. It was initial guidance. It was voluntary. And the animal industry didn't do anything. And so while, yes, the animal industry, as Richard mentioned, is following what the FDA is doing. They're also figuring out ways when it's voluntary, oh, yeah, we'll do it when we want to do it. And I don't think they're following through on what they should be and being responsible to the human health of this of all of us.
Now, Dr. Margaret Chan of the World Health Organization actually gave a statement just about a year ago where she said the overuse of antibiotics is becoming so common that she feared we're going to be headed for a day when normal infections could actually be deadly. And this is because bacteria have evolved to survive our treatments. And I think we get down to the basic question here, and I don't know if it's one that you can answer or that anybody here can answer, but it's a question of what produces more anti-resistant bacteria, treating major infections with large doses long-term or antibiotics with short-term low doses to prevent the bacteria from multiplying?
Yeah, you know, if you think about the number of bacteria that in the world, it's 5 times 10 to the 30. Right? There's always going to be more bacteria. We're always going to have them. And it's going to be this act of how do we manage our ability of treating our infections in the way that puts the most limited pressure on these bacteria so they don't change, so that they become resistant. Because guess what? They evolve, and they're going to want to survive. And so we have to do a lot of things. We have to stop using it when we don't have to. So since I don't think the animal industry has to use antibiotics to raise these animals. They don't have to have low doses in the feed to help them grow, to keep them healthy, to prophylax them in their protected conditions that, you know, are for protecting them, though they're on top of each other, they're cramped. I think, you know, that's why they're doing that.
But forgive me, now you're making the link there, and I wonder, you're treating patients. What I want to get at here is how do you see the connection in terms of what you're seeing with your patients?
Yeah, so with our own patients, the important piece is that we have to do a better job of finding the best doses with the best treatment lengths so that we know that. And that we need to do more research in that area. So, for example, when we look at how long we treat community-acquired pneumonia in a child, the recommendations from our national society, from a guideline published by the Infectious Disease Society of America, says that in children you should treat them for 10 days. And then if you look for the literature behind that recommendation, that is, well, that's because that's what we've done and there's no good randomized trials in certain areas that say we should treat less. That's where we have to figure these things out, and we have to do more of that. So that's one of the areas I think is really important.
But what are you seeing with kids coming in now that's different?
Yeah, so what we're seeing now, I mean, the best example for the listeners is thinking of urinary tract infections, very common infection that occurs in adults and children. And more recently, I even heard a story this morning from one of my partners. You know, we're having kids that come in, might have urinary tract symptoms like burning when they go to the bathroom or fever. We get a urine culture. We notice that they have an E. coli, very common bacteria. And now it's resistant to all of our common antibiotics that we can use over the counter or orally, such as amoxicillin, such as even the quinolones like ciprofloxacin, which we'll sometimes use in children if no other oral options are available. As a matter of fact, my colleague was in a predicament of having to choose an IV version was the only one that would work against that infection. And so now you're talking, well, do we give this child IV for 7 days, which has its own risk, putting in a semi-permanent line for 7 days? How do we do that orally? And we're seeing more of those. And not only we're seeing that, I've also unfortunately experienced treating a child who passed away because of a resistant infection, that the bacteria became resistant as we were treating them with the antibiotics. And as we went to the next, what we call broader spectrum or, you know, a bigger gun, so to speak, antibiotic, it became resistant to that, to where we gave what was the last one and we couldn't treat it. And that made it more real, obviously, to me, thinking, I don't think my father, who's a physician, ever would have thought that he would be in a place where he couldn't treat an infection because of all the antibiotics. And so now we're in this era where I think, like people have said, it's kind of like back before we had the sulfas and penicillins in the 1930s. And if you put that in perspective of, you know, world history, 1930 and it's 2013. I mean, we haven't even hit 100 years.
But this
and we're already talking about this.
Richard Carnevale, this is, from your perspective, not the result of the way animals are treated with antibiotics? That's minor, if at all, part of the equation?
Well, all I can say is there's not a lot of evidence that that the use of antibiotics in food-producing animals is really impacting these kinds of problems that he's talking about.
And you want to say, Jonathan Kaplan?
Yeah, I've been sitting on my hands here. I strongly disagree with that assertion. I think, you know, let me try a metaphor out here. Richard's perspective, I think, is one in which there's a pipe between the feedlots and consumers. And, you know, this is the food chain itself. So the bacteria that we have to worry about in this version of reality are only the, you know, it's the trickle of bacteria that come out and that you're exposed to on the raw meat that you buy in the grocery store. But I think that a lot of microbiologists and epidemiologists would argue that actually the reality is more like one in which we're all in a swimming pool, and the feedlots are at the other end of the pool from the rest of us, and the bacteria that are coming out of the feedlot circulate through our environment and can infect us in lots of different ways. It's not just about the food pathway.
Well, what about the point that was made by Richard Carnevale and has been made by others? Only two of the 18 antibiotics are resistant threats that are discussed in this report.
Exactly. Well, let's first of all not dismiss the two. I think they add up to about 400,000 illnesses a year, which are some of the biggest numbers in this report, and they're listed as a serious threat by CDC. But I believe that many of the researchers who are in this field would say that's probably the tip of the iceberg. And the bigger question is this issue of, you know, how much of the other infections that are in this report, the hospital infections, might be attributed to livestock use. And I think that's an open and very serious question. For example, there was a paper that was published this week, I think on the same day as the CDC report came out, showing that people who live closer to feedlots and fields where feedlot manure was applied have a 30% greater risk of contracting MRSA.
That's the Johns Hopkins study out
of
Pennsylvania.
That's right. So not just being a carrier, but actually having the disease, and that includes both hospital-acquired MRSA and community-acquired MRSA.
Yeah, but they didn't necessarily show MRSA specific. In fact, MRSA is in decline. But I want to open this up to listeners. I want to give Richard Carnevale an opportunity to respond to in more detail. But you may want to weigh in here. And if you do, you're certainly cordially invited. We're talking about antibiotic use in livestock tied to drug-resistant infections. And we welcome your phone calls and your emails. And you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to us, you can join the program and the conversation. Questions or comments, welcome. Again, 866-733-6786 or email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, and you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle, @KQED Forum. Again, we invited the CDC. They were unavailable to join us, but we're talking with Jonathan Kaplan, director of the Food and Agricultural Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council, Jason Newland, who is medical director of patient safety with Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri, and Richard Carnevale, vice president with Regulatory, Scientific, and International Affairs for the Animal Health Institute and Animal Pharmaceutical Industry Lobbying Group. And when we return, we'll hear from you, our listeners. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about antibiotic use in livestock tied to drug-resistant infections. On Monday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed a link between antibiotics given to livestock and the increase of antibiotic-resistant bacteria infections in people. And at least 70% of all antibiotics in the United States are used to treat animals on farms and feedlots, and critics are urging for better regulations. And we're discussing the CDC report and what it means. We're talking with Jason Newland, who is Medical Director of Patient Safety at Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri, Jonathan Kaplan, who is with us in studio, Director of the Food and Agricultural Program with the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Richard Carnevale, who is Vice President for Regulatory, Scientific, and International Affairs for the Animal Health Institute, an animal pharmaceutical industry lobbying group. And before I go to calls here, Richard Carnevale, I want to give you an opportunity just to respond to sort of, let me cut to the chase, if I may. Do we need more regulation? Does the CDC report, at least in your judgment, point to the need for more regulation?
Well, we have a lot of regulation now, and as I mentioned before, FDA is working on even more. They have moved in recent years to restrict the use of certain drugs like fluoroquinolones in poultry a number of years ago. They recently reduced the extra-label use, as it's called, of cephalosporins in food-producing animals. So they have been continuing to improve and take actions as they deem necessary. The latest, as I mentioned, the latest move is to phase out the use of growth-promoting antibiotics and put a lot of those products under veterinary control. So when that's all in place, that will even be another layer of protection beyond the layers of protection that are already there with the FDA regulatory process, the USDA meat inspection program, and the monitoring that goes on of both residues, antibiotic residues, and bacteria.
But what about regulating?
I mean, we have a lot of regulations now.
No, I didn't understand from your perspective that's certainly the case. What about regulating for the use of sick animals only, or for not necessarily buying over-the-counter antibiotics in a feed store?
Well, I just said that they were moving to put those antibiotics under veterinary control. So that is part of what the FDA plan to do, is to take those medically important antibiotics and no longer have them available to the layman. They would have to be used only under the order of a veterinarian. As far as using only for sick animals, well, animal medicine, food animal medicine, is a little different than human medicine. You don't have the luxury of treating an individual patient frequently because you have herds and flocks, and so you really need to look at herd health, and you really need to be able to manage the illness in a herd or flock or a group of animals before it spreads to the rest of them. So there always will be a need for control uses of antibiotics to stem an outbreak or to even prevent something that you know is likely to occur. So you cannot simply restrict veterinarians to treating individual animals. You cannot simply do that with poultry, for example. You've got 9 million chickens and turkeys slaughtered in this country every year. You can't treat an individual chicken or turkey. You've got to treat it on a flock basis.
I've got some listeners here who want to get on the line with us, and I'm going to go to your calls here in just a moment. But just to follow up with you for a moment, Richard Carnevale, a number of people are saying they can't believe that you talk about factory farms as not being crammed, or and wonder if you. One listener says, "Have you ever really? Has Mr. Carnevale actually ever been to a factory farm?" Because he sounds terribly misinformed. But I've also got a listener here who says, "Mr. Carnevale is avoiding the problem that most antibiotics are related to each other in several groups of action on bacteria, and bacteria share DNA easily with other bacteria, sort of like passing information on how to beat car doors locks increases successful car theft. So any resistance to one antibiotic in the group confers partial or total resistance to the others in the same group, and the most successful bacteria live to pass their DNA to others. So the new bacteria won't be hurt by common antibiotics, and less common bacteria are much more expensive and more toxic to the patients."
Yeah, that's a really important point. I was hoping we'd get to that.
Yes.
It may be that most of the bacterial resistance that we see are bacteria that were never actually exposed to the original antibiotic, but got their resistance traits handed to them by other bacteria. And, you know, scientists have documented that this gene transfer can happen in the human intestine. It can happen in soil outside the feedlot. And, you know, going back to my swimming pool metaphor, if we're all in this pool together and we're spreading antibiotic-resistant DNA throughout the swimming pool, we are creating more and more chances for that genetic traits end up in very virulent pathogenic bacteria.
Although I do want to footnote the fact that that study we referenced in Pennsylvania, Johns Hopkins study, did not necessarily prove anything in the soil. Richard Carnevale, let me get a response from you.
Well, there was an awful lot said there. I don't know that I can respond to everything. You know, certainly bacteria can share DNA, yes. I mean, it gets down to a matter of what is the evidence that FDA needs to take action against a certain situation. A lot of this is speculation. A lot of it's based on science that's generated in the laboratory. A lot of it is supposition that this is happening and that it actually leads to human health problems. But until you can actually document a direct path, a link to these problems, and say, yes, we have compelling evidence to show that something that happens on the farm can actually lead to human illness. And what I'm saying is that a lot of risk assessments have been done out there looking at the link between farm to table. And so far, it shows an exceedingly low risk. And I hearken back to the CDC report. Dr. Frieden did not characterize the CDC report as pointing the finger directly at agriculture as the problem. It did talk about it. But the bottom line is that the majority of those pathogens that occur, resistant problems in human medicine, have nothing to do with animals. And until there's a proven link between animals, then it has to remain that this is those pathogens are a human health concern. And it does not, the link to animals simply is not there.
All right, let me bring our callers into this. I wanted to get as many on as I can. Emily, you're first up. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to address Mr. Carvalho.
Carnevale.
I've worked in the supply chains of major grocery stores like Safeway as their senior sustainability manager. And I was tasked a few years ago with really looking into this issue of antibiotics in the food chain. I no longer work at Safeway. I moved on to the country's largest food service provider. And I just want to say I've been on multiple tours of chicken farms, pig farms, cattle ranches, both small and large, looking at the differences in these production facilities, as you call them. And while we have many, many people that are increasing their meat consumption, I think it's very, very important to point out that, indeed, as much as a fantasy wants to be created, these growing conditions for these livestock animals is crowded. It's cramped. It's dank. And I've never seen anything quite like it. When these animals are then cared for by the farming operations, they are also just going to the bathroom, and it's running out into these open sewage pits and ditches. And I believe that the subtherapeutic uses of antibiotics is not necessary if we improve these living conditions, improve the lives of these animals. I don't think our forefathers would have ever imagined the type of issue that we would get ourselves into in facing this issue with animal production today. I'm not necessarily an animal rights activist, but I truly believe once we start looking at humane farm animal care, we will see a reduced need for antibiotics in these food chains. And we're looking at a pandemic here. We're looking at an epidemic, and I think that CDC report put it very well, which is we're looking at a post-antibiotic era. I almost lost my mother a few years ago to an unbelievable, infection in the hospital while she was having a simple surgery. And it was because she had contracted an infection that the doctors didn't know how to cure. Thank God she made it. And I just want to say, on behalf of supply chains everywhere, this is a problem.
All right, Emily, I appreciate your call. Right. Richard Carnevale, go ahead.
This is actually Jason Newland. I think Richard's trying to make this point about there's no link, and between animal, kind of this food animals and the link over to humans. And, I think we have to be factual on some of this, and I think it's really important. And that's not true because, there's been recent papers showing, one that was published in the Clinical Infectious Diseases here in the springtime, showing that an MRSA, so methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, that we all know, and I think most listeners and people that aren't in medicine have heard of, there was a link between a pig strain of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus causing human disease. And that's a link. And it was not just we found it on the human. It was an actual human disease. And so there's one. And why would we have MRSA in pigs? Well, it's part of it's just why we have MRSA in humans. It's because we started using antibiotics like crazy so we can make things what we consider better. And until we start realizing that this is more than just a human health problem, this is also an animal food production industry problem, we're gonna keep running into more and more problems with antibiotic-resistant infections.
Well, I want to read actually a comment, and then again, this is Jason Newland, Medical Director of Patient Safety with Children's Mercy Hospital and Clinic in hospitals and clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. But Mike writes, I'll go to more of your calls in just a moment, but Richard Carnevale, a listener named Mike, says, why should we have to prove that it's dangerous? It seems that, like with drug approval, the industry should have to prove that it is, in fact, safe before we allow them to use these antibiotics. It's well known in microbiology that virulence factors or resistance genes can be swapped between various organisms. That point again. The fact that Salmonella, as the guest argues, the only bacteria that cross species is not the issue. And another listener, and I suppose this is the sentiment one can say of a number of emails we're getting, says, whenever I hear a lobbyist saying how the industry they represent follows all applicable laws, I'm unimpressed. Often the industries are the ones writing the laws or lobbying to get them watered down. There's a huge gap between what is required by law and what is best for our health.
Well, if I can respond, the industry does comply, does have to prove these products are safe before they're on the market.
Right.
So I'm not sure I understand that. There are, as I said, there's a very rigorous approval process in place, and then they're monitored after they're on the market.
Yeah.
So they do have to go through a safety evaluation.
AHI is on record, I believe, Richard, supporting FDA's proposed regulation, which is, you know, as we've said previously, a voluntary approach. And in fact, not only is it voluntary, but it's flawed in that it doesn't actually discourage prevention uses of the drugs. And even if pharmaceutical companies adopted, complied with the rule, we're concerned that the existing uses could continue but would just be relabeled from being growth promotion uses to disease prevention uses. So, in fact, there is not a real proposal on the table even to tackle this problem. You know, one of the big concerns I have with industry's position on all this is that there's utter secrecy in the industry about which drugs are actually used on which animals and how much. The livestock industry has refused to be transparent on this issue. We hear from Richard and his colleagues that everything's safe, they're using these drugs responsibly, and yet it's a black box. We have no idea what the actual uses and trends and practices.
I've got a lot of people waiting to talk here, but Richard Carnevale, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that question about non-transparency.
Well, you know, I would disagree. I don't think there's any big secrecy about what's being used. Before FDA required the reporting of the antibiotic sales data, AHI voluntarily reported data on what antibiotics were being used. And it's pretty common knowledge that, you know, what a lot of those antibiotics are used for. There's no big mystery that a lot of tetracyclines are
That's not true. We don't know if the drugs are being used in pigs or chickens or both or how much. And
yes,
how
do.
Much is for disease prevention? How much for growth promotion?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Well, we did a survey where we asked the companies how much they're selling for strictly growth promotion. And they said about 13, anywhere from 13 to 17%. Was the highest figure.
But that wasn't that was their answer without you weren't monitoring that. That was just their response, right?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to get that on the record too. I want to get another caller in here. Scott joins us from San Diego. Scott, welcome.
All right, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering, my wife is from Germany, and so we spend quite a bit of time over there, and I used to be outraged at our budget for food because she really promotes buying organic and has all these different requirements of what we buy, and I really wasn't on board with it. Until she did the arguments for me and kind of got me into reading, and it really had me concerned. And I was wondering what the panelists thought of the regulatory agencies in Europe when I look at things like the pesticide that we have now determined is affecting the bee population and see all these bee colonies dying. Europe's restricted it, but in America we haven't restricted it. And it seems like the FDA is a little bit slow to respond to some of these things, potentially maybe because of lobbyists. And so I'm wondering if that's going to continue, if the international market will affect us. And then I was curious for the panelist, second question is what do you guys look for in labeling when you can buy meat at the store?
Well, as long as you bring up Europe, we should mention that Denmark has some pretty broad restrictions on use of antibiotics, but the total amount of antibiotic prescribed for treating animal infections is actually up, and animal mortality and bacteria aren't always killed. Some survive by mutating and the like. We were talking about this actually off air, but Jonathan...
Yeah, I have a different understanding of that. I think the most recent statistics show that in Denmark, where we have probably the world's most progressive, restrictive antibiotic use policy, has resulted in total use of antibiotics decreasing by about half over the 10 years or so that this program's been in effect. And meanwhile, actually, pork production has gone up by about 50%. So it's been economically successful, and for some bacteria, at least, researchers are finding lower rates of antibiotic resistance.
Well, would some say, Richard Carnevale, that the differences between the United States and Europe are the way lobbying exists here? Some might say that.
No, I think it has to do with the policy positions that Europe takes. The scientific when Denmark imposed their ban, and it was proposed to go through all of Europe, a scientific advisory group in Europe reviewed the science behind that proposal and said, we don't have the evidence to enforce this ban. But the European Commission did it anyway under the rubric of the precautionary principle, because they have a different way of looking at hazards and risks over there, and they base some of their decisions not on science, but on political expediency. But let me talk about Denmark, because yes, Denmark imposed a ban on growth promoting antibiotics many years ago, and what we did see was a significant increase in therapeutic use of antibiotics to treat a lot of those infections that the quote growth promoters were keeping under control. That has cost the industry, it's maybe not very transparent, but that's cost the industry at least $1.50, maybe $2 per pig to do that, and it's caused a lot of consolidation over there. A lot of farmers went out of business because of it. Now, the bottom line is, that's fine. They did that, they reduced antibiotic use overall, and they accomplished what they wanted, but they cannot claim that they improved human health, because there's no evidence that human health was improved, and even they admit that.
All right, I want to bring another caller on. That's Lorna. Good morning.
Good morning. Great program. I work with a number of doctors. We just started a nonprofit in Hawaii to address certain issues regarding consumer health care plans and all of this. But one of the major things that we're looking at and has been slightly addressed here is that the industry itself, with the animal husbandry and the farming and all of that, has for years been covering up issues and dumping the results onto the consumer base. A study that was 25 years in the making between five universities in the Ohio, Michigan, Indiana area showed that 75% of the eggs in the United States that are for consumption are leukemia carriers. That never even hit the consumer market. And the fact that there are other issues going on, like the mad cow issue, where if you were following any of that, it was the feed sources that the industry was using, because these are vegetarian animals, that were basically causing these horrible prions to be developed and the beta amyloid plaque and the rise in Alzheimer's that we're seeing. You cannot just look at studies that are recent and that have a short a short-term study program, because cancers and Alzheimer's and all of these degenerative diseases take many years to develop. So you have to look at the rise of these diseases over time. I say that the industry itself needs to be held responsible for the way that they are raising these cattle, raising the chicken population, that the fact is that they need to be much more highly regulated, and the consumer should not be the scapegoat nor the victim in this picture.
All right. I thank you for that comment. We'll let it stand as an editorial comment, because I want to read some more comments that are pouring in here. On the website, Cherry writes, my children raised lambs for 4-H last year, and I was dismayed to find the feed has antibiotics in it. I don't feel comfortable feeding animals antibiotics as a preventative measure. Furthermore, pharmaceuticals pass through the animal and end up in our waterways. And Robert writes, whatever happened to the precautionary principle? It seems we increasingly give precaution a backseat to company and industry interest these days. We're facing a serious health threat here. The animal feed industry should be under the burden of proof that they are not causing damage, not the other way around. The Danish pig farming industry provides a fantastic example of how changing practices can be great for the public, the industry, and, well, better for pigs, at least for their life duration. If it looks like a serious risk, it's likely industry should be under the burden of proof to show it is not. And another listener writes, what about cycling through different antibiotics year to year to avoid resistant strains? What would you think about that, Dr. Newland?
Yeah, you know, I think this is what the caller just, that point she made is really important that I was thinking about is regarding to some more recent literature talking about our microbiome and the fact that, you know, our microbiome is all this bacteria that's in our, you know, guts. You know, in our intestines, and that there's probably a significant health benefit to our own microbiome. And when we're putting in, and you know, we're eating things that have probably antibiotics in them, obviously because we have such a high amount of antibiotic use in these animals, there's probably some impact in regards to what we're doing to our intestinal microbiome and the health.
Not
the impact
true.
On health.
Not true.
Well,
antibiotics are not in your food.
Well, it's in the water supply. We're probably getting these low levels that are coming through that we'll see. And I think that part of that, and I think that also impacts our also human health use of antibiotics, that microbiome has an impact. And that we will need to look into that more and more about why we're seeing, you know, maybe more allergic type disease. Some people would like to make the link of our excess use of antibiotics with obesity, all about this microbiome. So I think it's a very interesting concept. And I want to still go back to the fact is, you don't need all these antibiotics used in the animal industry, so why do it?
Well, you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Jason Newland, Jonathan Kaplan, and Richard Carnevale. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED Public Radio, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And I'm going to go to another caller, and that's Shio. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. You had a guest on that wrote a book entitled Pharmacology with an F, not a PH. But there was a
friend. That was Daphne Miller by name, yes.
Yeah.
Dr. Daphne Miller, right.
Yes. Cody Holmes is a rancher in Missouri.
Yeah.
And he's converted, and he's business-wise, he's very successful. And I'm wondering if there's plans to have control groups, farmers that use less antibiotics. And you mentioned Europe, but I'm just wondering if there's anything in this state here that's
Can you speak to that, Richard Carnevale? Is there any plans that you know of along those lines? That is to do experimental groups and farmers?
The industry is always looking for ways to improve production without external additions. In other words, if antibiotics weren't working to prevent some of the diseases they need to prevent, they wouldn't use them because it costs money. It costs money, and margins are very slim for producers these days. So, yeah, there's probably a lot of research going on for alternatives. But a lot of them haven't really panned out to be as useful as some of the antibiotics that are being used. So, yeah, there's certainly research going on.
And let me thank Shio for her call and move to a caller from Indiana. Vince, join us. Hi.
Yes, I hope I can get my point across. What is the correlation between the hormones that they give them to grow a cow or a chicken faster? And they feed them corn rather than being a grazer because it takes 3 years to raise a cow if you graze, and 6 to 8 months to eat a cow when you feed it corn and give it growth hormones. Well, and cancers have increased. I looked at my 10-year-old daughter yesterday, and she looks 16. And don't you think that has anything to do with the food that we eat? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the call. The question's out there. Who wants to step up to the plate here?
I don't obviously raise animals in that respect, but I think back to the last...
Jason Newland.
Yes, so Jason Newland. The last point is that, I think there probably is an impact on growth in regards to when we're feeding them corn and not grass. And I think that likely has something to do with the fact that these animals do look sicker, and maybe they have to use these antibiotics because they are raising them not like they were intended to grow. And I think in regards to the previous caller to this one was that they were asking about, you know, are there other farmers that have been able to raise and be successful without antibiotics and doing kind of this sustainable farming? And there's a number of them. You can Google Russ Kramer, who is considered the Pope of pork in Missouri, who has a co-op of pork farm raisers who will give you his own story of when he realized this wasn't the way. And he'll argue that when he went away from the antibiotics and this mass production, his animals looked healthier, and that they didn't need the antibiotics like they did when he was raising them in the industrial style. If you look at White Oaks Pastures out in Georgia by Will and Jenny Harris, they raise many different breeds and are doing successful and have a large operation. And so I think it and again, I'm not an expert in obviously the farm industry and that aspect, but they would tell you, at least in my discussion with them, and say this can be sustainable and that farmers can do this and be successful.
Right. And Russ is another great example of the animal to human exposure pathway. Russ contracted an infection. He got gored by one of his pigs, contracted a resistant infection that almost killed him. He spent a lot of time in the hospital and survived it and came out of that experience and decided to completely transform his production system and get away from it.
We've got
drugs.
Just another minute or so left. I want to get a final word from you, Richard Carnevale. Maybe sum up.
Let me just go back to the hormones. Hormones are not used in chickens. I want to make sure that people understand that. The caller mentioned that, and it's not true. The hormones that are used in beef have been approved safe by the FDA, and not only by the FDA, by the international organization called Codex, which works for the World Health Organization. So there is not a hormone residue problem in meat, and this idea that somehow it's affecting human health because of residues in meat certainly is not proven by the science.
Well, we're going to have to conclude there. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us. Richard Carnevale, again, is Vice President of Regulatory, Scientific, and International Affairs for the Animal Health Institute, an animal pharmaceutical industry lobbying group. Jason Newland is Medical Director of Patient Safety with Children's Mercy Hospitals and Clinics in Kansas City, Missouri. And Jonathan Kaplan directs the Food and Agricultural Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. We will continue, obviously, to follow this story, and I appreciate not only our guests being with us this hour, but you, our listeners, who called in and expressed your own concerns as well as giving us questions and comments to work with here. We have another hour, obviously, of forum coming up. I hope you will join us for that. We're going to hear a really extraordinary story of a young woman who was actually taken, literally, and kidnapped by Islamic fundamentalists in Somalia and held for about 14 months. She'll be joining us along with her co-author. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Don Zoll, and also our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.